Cancer Center will be speaking on matters unsettled by science. And then following that, there are two further lectures in this series. To introduce Dr. Clark Kerr, our speaker this evening, I would call upon the Chief Justice of the Province of British Columbia, the Honorable Nathan Nemetz.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege and honor for me to introduce our distinguished guest tonight, whom I've known for some considerable time. Before I do so, I'd like to also mention to you, we have the great pleasure of having Mrs. Kerr here tonight, and I know, Mr. Chairman, on your behalf and all of us, we welcome her to British Columbia since she came up with Dr. Kerr. We have just returned from Victoria, where the Universities Councils of Canada have been meeting in session, and where we've had the wise advice given to us by one of the United States' most eminent educators, I should say one of the Western world's most famous educators. I had the great pleasure of meeting him first when he was in Seattle doing work which I was interested in at the time, and industrial relations. And later on, we had the great pleasure of attending the International Universities Conference in Tokyo, where we took part in the proceedings there. It's with great, I've watched, as you have undoubtedly, watched this distinguished career of this professor who started at the University of Washington and ended in the highest echelon of universities in the Western world. He was born in Pennsylvania on a farm. He took his Bachelor of Arts degree at Swarthmore and his Master of Arts at Stanford University, his PhD at Berkeley. He taught at Antioch and Berkeley and Stanford and our neighboring University of Washington from 1940 to 1945. And it was from there that he was chosen to become director of the Institute of Industrial Relations at Berkeley in 1945. From 1952 to 58, he was the chancellor. That is an American terminology. That is, he was the president of one of the eight units of the University of California at Berkeley. And later, he was appointed the president of the entire California system, where he served with distinction for almost 10 years. On his departure, during the unhappy period of time when the governor and the university had deep and abiding problems, and there was a parting of the ways, Dr. Kerr became noted through the entire scholarly world as a defender and of academic freedom. For this great fight that he put up in California, he was later awarded the Alexander Michael John Award for contributions, distinguished contributions, to academic freedom. After he left, he was recruited by the Carnegie Foundation, who chose him to be the chairman of its Commission on Higher Education. And for over a span of 6 years, he chaired that distinguished series of scholars who produced one of the great landmarks in education in the Western world, a report which people have said certainly rivaled the great Flexner report of earlier times in the United States. He stayed on as chairman of the Carnegie Foundation Policy Studies until 79. He is a writer, as you can imagine, of distinguished articles, books on various subjects in this field, Harvard, Princeton, and many and many other universities have granted him honorary degrees. He's a scholar, administrator, arbitrator, author. I have great pleasure in calling upon him to address us tonight.
Mr. Chief Justice, and ladies and gentlemen, and at least one fellow Californian here this evening. It's a very great pleasure to return to Vancouver once again. My first visit here was just over 40 years ago at the invitation of a gentleman a good many of you will know and all of you will know about, and that's Gordon Shrum, who's sitting here in the first row. Gordon has initiated so many things of value to British Columbia. The thing he initiated with me, I don't know was ever any value or not, but he did initiate it. I was then a young instructor at the University of Washington teaching in the field of industrial relations. And he had the idea that there ought to be some study of industrial relations begun in the British Columbia area, particularly at the University of British Columbia, and invited me up to talk about the field and try to develop some interest in its development here. And so Gordon was my first introduction, and it's a very great pleasure to see him here this evening. At that time, my talk was on the subject of the prospects for industrial relations. As you may remember, there had been some extremely bitter strikes in Canada and the United States. In the 1930s, a good deal of violence and a certain amount of blood as the trade unions tried to penetrate industry with their organization. And I was then predicting that this period would pass, that labor relations were not moving the direction of class warfare, as a few people then hoped and many people feared, but that they would settle down to business-like relations and become a part of democratic society, as has been, by and large, the case. I'd like to thank the Chief Justice for his introduction. He pointed out the problems associated with my leaving the University of California and conflict with a new governor with whom I was arguing over the autonomy of the university and the university budgets and many, many other things. And I said as I left the position that I was leaving the presidency of the University of California exactly as I entered it, which was fired with enthusiasm. On the way in, it was my own. On the way out, it was that of the new governor of the state, since then better known nationally and internationally than he was at that particular time. But things were made more or less right for me some years later. It's always very nice to be given the title emeritus at the time you retire from a position. It's even nicer when the title is given to you 7.5 years later. They still remember you. And the Board of Regents, 7.5 years later, in the absence of the governor, unanimously gave me this title, with the motion made by the man who had moved to dismiss me, second by the person who had seconded the motion. And then the San Francisco Chronicle, which is famous for its typographical errors, but I think on this occasion I must have had a friend in the composing room, had as the title on the article, they intended to say, "Kern named President Emeritus by Board of Regents." It came out, "Kern named President Emeritus by Board of Repents." Now, I regret the confusion about what I'm to be talking about this evening. Mrs. Nemetz, when we met the faculty club a few minutes ago, was asking me, what am I really talking about? Is it Poland? Is it about the future of industrial society? Is it about higher education or a combination of all three? I thought, well, maybe I might ask you what I was talking about. But it occurred to me that might be a little bit risky. I thought of an episode involving my predecessor as president of the University of California, Robert Gordon Sproul, who had been president for 28 years, and he felt that he had moved in that period of time away from the students and didn't know them, and they didn't know him. And he was walking across the campus one night, and he met a student, and he thought he would strike up a conversation. So he says to the student, do you know who I am? And the student looked him up and down and said, no, sir, I don't. But if you have any idea at all as to where you live, I'd be glad to help you find your way home. So I thought I'd better find my way home from what was the announced topic. I wasn't announced originally as speaking upon academic life in Poland, and to my regret, I'm not in a position to do so. I'd like to, for any of you who came because you thought that might be the title, I'd like to say a word about the change. Under the circumstances which I had anticipated, I would just a few days ago have returned from 2 weeks in Poland, another week interviewing Polish emigres in London and in Paris, and concerned with the state of institutional autonomy, university autonomy, and academic freedom in Poland. I was to be the chairman of an international group concerned with this problem. The other two Americans were to be President Ted Hesburgh of Notre Dame, you may have heard about him, and the current president of NYU, and former Democratic leader in the House of Representatives. But at the last moment, with a new minister of foreign affairs in Poland, the hardest liner of the Polish leaders today, revoked the permission to go, and explaining that the time was not appropriate. Our group still hopes to go at some time. We have told the Polish government that we intend to render a report on what has happened to academic freedom and to university autonomy in Poland, whether they let us in or not, and that we would hope they would feel that it would be better for them to give us a chance to listen to them and see the situation firsthand rather than rely upon what we can find out from the documents and the very large number of Polish intellectual emigres in Western Europe and the United States, and perhaps some here in Canada. I'd been in Poland just a year ago. I have several very good friends there. And Poland at that time was a free country. With the exception of one person who turned up a radio when he was saying some things he thought were particularly delicate, everybody was talking quite freely. And then in December, of course, there descended martial law. And in the course of this past summer, there has been undertaken a purge which has removed by now most of the rectors of the Polish universities and also a number of faculty members. We'd hoped to make a report upon this and at least to call the attention of Polish authorities that what they do to the academic community in Poland is not of concern to the Poles at all, but to the academic world at large and to all people concerned with human freedom. We still have in our application to go. Hope that at some time it may be found appropriate for us to be there. And if not, we do expect to render a report on the circumstances which have developed there. So instead of speaking about Poland, I'm going to be talking about prospects for higher education over approximately the next 20 years. With reference to the United States, to some extent to Canada, though I know your situation much less well, and to some extent to the United Kingdom and Western Europe. Then I look forward to the period for discussion and what your comments and questions may be. Higher education in Western Europe and North America, and also in Australia, New Zealand, other parts of the world, is now going through a second great crisis in a period of only 20 years. The first of these crises came in the 1960s, particularly the early 1960s, when there was the greatest period of growth of higher education that the world has ever seen, and by a very wide margin. In Western Europe, higher education just really exploded. Here also in North America, in the decade of the 1960s alone, the number of students in institutions of higher education tripled in both Canada and the United States. In the case of the United States, in that one decade, there was three times as much growth in student numbers as had taken place in the 330 years since Harvard was founded in 1636. Very great growth in Latin America, in Africa. I visited a number of the new universities being built in both of those continents, Australia, India, and Japan. 20 years ago, the great discussion in the United Kingdom was the Robbins Report and the new declaration of British policy that higher education should be available on demand, the demand of capable students, and the number should not be restricted in a more artificial way. Here in North America, we were talking about the tidal wave of students which was about to engulf us. Now, 20 years later, we have another crisis, and this is the crisis of the cessation of growth and the prospects of decline. In the United Kingdom, as most of you will know, they've undertaken a program of reducing the funding of higher education over 3 years by 15%, which has never happened before, that kind of a decline, increased also by the impacts of inflation. In Australia, during the course of this year, they have reduced appropriations for higher education by 5%. I was in the United Kingdom on the same trip that took me to Poland a year ago, just after the announcements of the new policy by the UGC. I had a chance to have a lunch with the chairman of the UGC and with other people well informed about the situation, and got some sense of the great turmoil which was created by this program of decline. And then a few months later in Australia, where the impacts were confined to only 1 year, they didn't face 15%, only 5% at a time, but it may add up to be 15% or more. In the United States, there are already declines setting in, particularly severe in the states of Oregon and Washington, but also Michigan and Ohio and various other states. I was in Oregon on the way up here and was told that at the University of Western Oregon this fall, enrollments had dropped by 20%. Now, higher education takes change very hard. Institutions of higher education are very conservative institutions about their own affairs. However radical it may seem that faculty members are sometimes about everybody else's affairs, they are, having dealt with unions and government agencies and corporations, I've never seen a group more conservative about its own affairs and more liberal or radical about everybody else's than faculty members. And so change on campus, however easy it may look to change society, change on campus comes very hard. You may remember back to the slogan of the early 1960s, coined in Britain but I'm sure you used it here, as in the United States. And the phrase was, more is worse. In the 1980s, the phrase might be, less is disastrous. Now, higher education historically doesn't change all that much. The last time that higher education in the United Kingdom, in the United States, changed to the extent it has, these two great changes in the last 20 years, was over a century ago in the 1860s and 1850s. And few changes of great importance in between. In the 1850s and 1860s, a series of royal commissions transformed Oxford and Cambridge from rather moribund institutions, open only to males who were members of the Anglican Church and who taught where largely the classics were taught and opened them up to modern development. In the United States, the Land Grant Act, the time of President Lincoln in the 1860s, also brought comparable changes to the United States. But in the intervening century, rather gradual growth and not all that much change. And generally, academics, when they have change forced upon them, are found kicking and screaming all the way as they are today. Now, the reasons for the cessation of growth and the prospect of decline are well known to everyone. First of all, the demographic depression from which you seem to be immune, but that quite distinguishes you from most other places in the world. The demographic decline in the United States, and I think the figures for Canada as a whole are almost the same. The size of the college-going age cohort in 1997 will be 23.5% less than it is in the fall of 1982. In Britain, the decline is somewhat greater than that. In Germany, it's even greater, a decline of about one-third. In the United States, there's only one state that is bound to be immune from this demographic decline, and that is the state of Utah, which is, first of all, advancing economically in various ways. And second, it's a state populated by good Mormons who never went along with the decline of the birth rate that began taking place in the early and middle 1960s. And in Utah, there will be no demographic depression. From what I've been told here, there probably will not be here either because of the heavy in-migration. But this will distinguish British Columbia and Utah from the other provinces of Canada, from the other states in the United States, from what's going to happen in Great Britain, all of Western Europe, Sweden a slight exception because it did not participate in World War II, and Australia and New Zealand. Another reason for cessation of growth and possible decline is the economic situation. We have fallen, particularly in the last decade, into continuing stagflation with alternating excessive inflation and then excessive unemployment as a way to overcome the inflation, and increasingly excessive inflation and excessive unemployment at one and the same time. Arthur Oaken of Brookings Institution, recently deceased, coined the phrase the discomfort index for Western economies, discomfort index being adding together the rate of inflation and the rate of unemployment. And not so long ago, that discomfort index was about the level of 5. In intervening years, it's gone up to 15 or 20 and may go higher. And no one knows the answers to the problem. And it's likely that this fluctuation of inflation, fluctuation of unemployment, stagflation may go on for a very long period of time. Now, reasons for cessation of growth and also possible decline in higher education is also because of the past success of higher education in the several countries of Western Europe and North America and Australia and New Zealand. One of the great success stories in the history of civilization was how in so many countries it was possible to vastly increase the number of students, at the same time, at a minimum, not reducing the quality of the education and research, and more realistically, I think, at least increasing the quality of the research and the work, the training at the PhD level. An enormous success. In the course of that success, in a number of locations, too many campuses were built, and higher education is now overbuilt. The tidal wave of students was met. No young person on this continent was really turned away, despite the vast increases of number, because there was not a place for that young person. An enormous success. Likewise, when that period of expansion began, there were great shortages in the labor market. There were shortages of computer specialists, shortages of doctors, shortages of many people. In higher education in Western Europe and North America, these other countries, was successful in fulfilling all the needs of expanding industrial society, even to the point in a number of fields of creating a surplus of highly trained people. So partly because we were so successful in the past, given enormous challenges by our societies, we now find ourselves in a period of cessation or growth. Related to that, let me say, has been a very drastic decline in what economists call the private rate of return on a university education. The private rate of return is calculated by taking the private costs of going to college, including what economists call foregone earnings, and then the prospective increase in income the person will get over a lifetime for having attended college. And the rate of return on that investment has, in the last decade, in the several studies made in North America and Western Europe, gone down by 50%. And there are economists who will put together the decline in the size of the college-going age cohort and the decline in the private rate of return on a college education and come up, as they have in the United States, with estimates that enrollments may drop not the approximately 25% that the age cohort goes down, but even 40 or 50% on the ground it no longer pays to get a college or university degree from an economic point of view. Now, as we face these quantitative changes in numbers of students and also the sums of money available, there is this great first question of what will happen quantitatively. How far down will enrollments go in which institutions and in which geographical regions? And how far down will the sums of money in real terms go from one governmental jurisdiction to another? And quite obviously, these quantitative impacts are going to be quite unequally spread and have quite different consequences. There are going to be and are already many fewer new hires of young PhDs, slower promotions on campuses all over the Western world, slower rates of increases in faculty salaries, etc. Coming up, I think, also as a consequence will be more trade union activity on the campuses. So the first question is what will be the quantitative impacts on higher education? But there is a second question which has not yet been faced. and hardly been raised. And I'd like to turn to it now. And that is, what are the prospects or possibilities of qualitative decline during the period of quantitative decline? And what might be done about these prospects? Most institutions are going to survive the quantitative declines. I am very concerned, however, that they may experience rather severe qualitative declines. That higher education in the year 2000 will not, in a number of countries of Western Europe, North America, and the others we've mentioned, be of the quality it is today. And this will be a great tragedy, because industrial civilization all the time needs more highly trained people to handle the more complex technology and the more complex social organizations. It also needs at all times better and better research to overcome the problems which seem to grow upon us at all times. These are the reasons for my concern, and I don't really see the way out, although I think all of us interested in higher education should commit ourselves to having systems of higher education at least of equal quality in the year 2000 as in 1982. I have my doubts, my grave doubts, whether this will be possible. And let me give you the reasons why. And I'm more concerned about the tragedies on the qualitative side than the tragedies on the quantitative side. Many institutions, in the process of trying to handle quantitative decline, will lower their admission standards. Some have already. My own home campus, the University of California at Berkeley, has lowered its admission standards, modestly, but lowered them, not so much to keep students, but as the sums of money went down in real terms per student, the campus decided to increase the number of students to keep up its monetary intake. Many institutions are now thinking of reducing their admission requirements or have done so already. Many institutions are becoming very concerned with retention. A fairly substantial number of persons who enter colleges or universities do not complete their programs, 3 years in the UK, 4 years in North America. And the effort to retain these students, there'll be some reduction of attention to what their attainments may be. Already in the competition among institutions and within institutions, a one department versus another or one school versus another, there has been this grade inflation. So that what was once a C becomes a B, and what was a B becomes an A. Already before the demographic depression has really hit, and already before we've met the most serious declines in support for monetary support for higher education, there are institutions reducing their curricular requirements. Particularly, there is a blow in the United States, a second blow in the United States, to general education. Students, by and large, like more electives, fewer requirements. Many of the requirements for general education were wiped out the period of student unrest in the late 60s and early 70s. More are now being wiped out as students say we want to do whatever we want to do and unwilling to accept academic policy about what constitutes a good general education. I've seen, even at a great research university like Berkeley, in the competition among students and schools, among professors and schools, and departments and schools for students, a reduction in course requirements. and put it in courses which will attract the non-majors in particular. All of these things are going to create a kind of a golden age for the students. The 1960s were a golden age for faculty members, wanted everywhere. They're no longer even in a silver age. But for students, it will become a golden age. More and more people wanting to admit them and retain them, give them the grades they might desire, give them only those requirements which they would like to meet. Likewise, in a period of no growth, let alone decline, the faculties get older year by year, on the average, as no new people are employed. I don't mean to suggest this results in poor teaching. I think, by and large, the more senior faculty members tend to be the better teachers. But it does have the impact of freezing the resources of universities on existing fields and making it less possible for them to keep up with the dynamics of intellectual activity and develop the new fields that come along and subdivisions of fields. I'm particularly concerned about the flow of young scientists, whether there'll be jobs for them as they come along. And by the accounts of faculty members I talked to in many places, there never has been as good a crop of young PhDs generally and in science in particular as today. What positions will there be for them? To the extent there are positions, will they go into industry and government, where by and large the research activity, for many reasons, is not as effective as if they were in a university environment? And how to keep open opportunities for young scientists when under our enrollment-driven formulas there are no new professorships established because there are no additional students and maybe even fewer students than previously. The Carnegie study effort, which I chaired for a number of years, made very strong representations in Washington that for the sake of the national interest, there should be a program of making available to the research universities positions quite unrelated to enrollment demands, just so there could be a good flow of young scientists coming along for the sake of the nation. And we, of course, argued that the Western world, with more research done in the United States than in any other country in the Western world, finds itself once again in a very regrettable but very severe competition with the USSR and the countries dependent upon it. Another concern on the qualitative side, which I've seen several places, is a decline in academic morale. As promotions are slowed, as salaries do not keep up with the cost of living. I've also seen a number of places, as the threat of reductions comes along, the intense internal conflict which takes place, the scientists organizing against the humanists, and saying, don't cut the sciences, cut the humanities. And the scientists and the humanists then organizing against the School of Education or some other professional school which they think should be cut first. And this internal conflict can become very intense. And then another area which concerns me and where I'm now involved in a study is what's going to happen to leadership, the quality of leadership of higher education. There is an organization called the Associated Governing Boards, which is made up of trustees and regents from Canada and the United States. And at their two annual meetings in recent years, they've been talking about the fact that their common experience is it's getting harder to find people who are willing to be college and university presidents. That when they serve for a shorter period of time. And also they feel, this is their perception, that these people with the shorter periods of time, with all the current demands upon them, are giving less leadership in terms of long-term planning and taking of actions which will preserve the institution and a state of health in the long run. So they asked Professor David Reisman of Harvard University, some of you may know him for his famous volume, The Lonely Crowd, and various other books, myself, to make a study of what is happening to leadership. He's studying some institutions in depth. I'm going clear across the United States and talking with many people and asking how current presidents view the situation, past presidents. I'm talking with people I call refuseniks, people who refuse presidencies. I've talked with one woman who has turned down 10 college and university presidents all by herself. Why so many refuseniks? And generally the presidents say that their jobs are becoming tougher, and I think that's true. Tougher in several ways. There are now more veto groups on campus than there ever were before. Presidents have always had to do a lot of consultation. But consultation was considered to be enough. And out of the view of participatory democracy that spread in the late 60s and early 70s, these groups got the view not only that they had to be consulted, but that they must approve, that they had a veto right, and that in many institutions has been accepted. And as all the different constituencies agree, nothing can happen. Participatory democracy was introduced as a radical idea. If you got everybody in the institution involved, the masses involved, as well as the elite leadership, institutions would be more progressive and move faster. As a matter of fact, I think the most conservative thing to happen to higher education has been participatory democracy. Because when everybody has a veto, there's only one thing which cannot be vetoed, and that is the status quo. And so you find on many of these campuses these frustrated presidents who'd like to do something, surrounded by veto groups and unable to move. Another thing, it's a lot easier to manage growth than to manage decline. I went through a period of managing growth on the several campuses of the University of California, was involved in starting three new ones, San Diego, Irvine, and Santa Cruz. And it was a great challenge and a great thrill. I said to my successor, who had been one of my vice presidents in the university, a few years later, I said, Charlie, you're not working nearly as hard as I worked, those 90-hour weeks. It's a lot easier job than the one I had. He said, well, it's true I'm not working the hours you worked, but let me tell you, the job is a lot harder. You'll remember how every time after a regents meeting, which was once a month, you would sit down with the vice presidents and we would talk about what we had gained that month. I sit down with my vice presidents and talk about what we lost in the past month. So there is a problem of leadership. What kind of leadership will institutions of higher education have as these veto groups surround the possibilities, constrain the possibilities of change? And as the presidents have to try to manage decline, decide who's going to be cut rather than who's going to grow. And planning is a much more difficult matter. Planning for growth was relatively easy, much time that it took. You're always giving somebody something, not all they wanted, but giving them something. Planning for decline is an absolute disaster. It's almost impossible to plan decline because anybody who's going to be cut becomes irate about it, organizes about it, goes to the public, goes to the board, and causes difficulty in many, many ways. And I've seen tragedies around the United States involving those presidents who tried to plan for the future and thus creating intense enmity toward themselves. Some have had their careers, in fact, ruined by undertaking a responsible process of planning for decline. So generally, higher education in a period of no growth or decline is likely to be less dynamic. There'll be more emphasis upon a survival mentality. Sometimes in my worst dreams, I think that higher education might move somewhat not as far in its quality as the passenger railroad industry. So, on prospects for growth, prospects for the future, the quantitative problems, but I think the quantitative problems dwarfed by the qualitative problems that will follow upon them. Now, I've been talking about the period to the year 2000. Beyond 2000, there'll be growth again. The grandchildren of the children of the participants in World War II will be coming along. The demographic curve will turn up. Perhaps the economic situation will improve. All those faculty members hired in the 1960s will be retiring. And you can hire a new faculty between the year 2000 and 2010. All those buildings we built in the 1960s will either need to be replaced or greatly modified in a new period of growth as well. So I feel good about the period beyond 2000, but very concerned about the period from now to then, and particularly if you have as your goal that higher education should be at least as good in 2000 as in 1982. One final word. A long time ago, at least according to the Jowett translation, and generally this has been true throughout the intervening 2,500 years, not at all times and not in all places. Certainly the wheel of education slowed down very drastically in the early Middle Ages. Although that is in the Western world, at that time the great universities were in the Muslim world, the great university of Cordoba, Salerno, etc., which were inspirations for the founding University of Bologna and Salamanca, and etc. But at least beginning with the foundation of the modern universities in the 12th and 13th century, it would generally be true that the wheel of education has moved at an ever faster rate. And I think that however true this law of Plato has been in the past, it's an absolutely inviolable law in modern industrial society. That as far as human wisdom can see ahead, the wheel of education has to move faster so that we can keep up with the needs of industrial society, so that individuals can cope better with the many complex problems they face, so that people can improve their quality of life, even if the quality of goods and services available does not increase. So that in the long run, I would say the very basic law is a law of Plato, that education, and including higher education, will move at an ever faster pace, that education has to become, by the very nature of the circumstance, at all times and in almost all ways, a more important aspect of modern society. But that does not take care of the next 20 years, but I think it gives us some perspective on the next 20 years. That we're not just trying to survive the next 20 years. We're trying to survive the next 20 years because we'd like to have in the best possible shape some of the institutions which have been among the great glories of the advance of civilization in over a period of so very many centuries. And a good many of you here in this room are now involved and will be involved in the process of trying to maintain the vitality of universities, including your local universities, during what will be a very difficult period, but in a period where the secular increase has to be always at a faster and faster rate. That we have a responsibility, a great responsibility to ourselves today, to future generations of civilization, to keep these institutions in the best possible condition so that they can make the contributions that only they can make to the continuing welfare of civilization. Thank you.
Dr. Kerr has consented to respond to questions, if you have any.
Would you state the question?
Fine.
All right, over here. You want me to take them, Dr.?
Yes, would you do that?
Okay, all right.
You made an analogy with the passenger
right.
railroad trains.
Right.
You know the passenger train was somewhat supplanted by an airplane.
Yes.
I wondered what you had as for the thing which would correspond to the airplane compared to higher education. In particular, I wonder whether you would comment on lifelong continuing education as something which might be competing with higher education.
Yes. All right, the question, if you all didn't hear it, it's a partly a question and partly a statement or implied statement. That I made reference to what happened to the passenger railroads and hoping that wouldn't happen to higher education. Passengers' railroads are being supplanted by the airplane, also by the automobile and the bus, and et cetera, et cetera. Was there any airplane in the future for higher education, and particularly with the new technology that I take it was behind your comment about lifelong, become the airplane? I don't think there is any airplane coming. I've had a certain amount of interest in the new technology. And it does have some rather thrilling possibilities. But not replacing higher education or education we know it, but more as a supplement. Eric Ashby, Lord Ashby, once wrote an article called The Fourth Revolution, which said there have been four great revolutions in the history of education. One was when there were first teachers teaching just orally. Then second, when there was writing. Then third, when there was a book. And now fourth, the new electronic media. Our Carnegie group put out one of our publications and reports about the new technology, which we called, after Eric Ashby's comment, the Fourth Revolution. A few days later, we got the biggest order we ever got from a very left-wing college in Chicago. They said they want 1,000 copies of this report on the Fourth Revolution. By return mail, we got back 999. It wasn't the revolution they were interested in. But and then one of the new campuses I was involved in starting at Irvine, we set it up with terminals so that all students would have a chance to work with the new computers. So having looked at this, there are a fair number of prospects, but it's not going to take the place, as the airplane did of the railroad, of what we know as education. It's going to be a supplement and not in any way a replacement. A useful supplement, but that's really all. Just as writing did not replace the oral tradition, or the book replace writing, so the new technology will not replace the previous three. The place that's going to make the most difference is the one that you mentioned, and that is in continuing education. It will be possible, particularly when the new dishes become, as they will be within perhaps 5 years, within the means of nearly everybody, possible for people in their own homes to tune in on really all the knowledge of the world. But will they do it? What we found at Irvine was this. We set up these rooms with computer terminals. And then we found that the students, when they used the computer terminals, still wanted to talk to somebody. We found we had to build a seminar room and put a teaching assistant or somebody there. They could talk about the lesson and back and forth, this and that. It's not something which really somehow inspires people the way the personal contact does. So I say a useful supplement, but not a new airplane. All right, are there questions or comments? Yes, here. I see a lot of lessons from the Western world to China. I was chairman of a U.S. delegation several years back, just after the end of the Cultural Revolution. And at that time, the figures have gone up somewhat since then. They had 0.6% of their young people taking education after high school. We tried to carry to the message to them that no modernizing society, let alone a modernized society, could possibly be effective unless at least 10% of the young people had education beyond the high school level. We were particularly concerned with the relationship between work and education. And we had read about what had been done in the Cultural Revolution to combine work and education. And I must say we came back quite convinced that that was more, a great deal more propaganda and theory than reality. We found little gardens in connection with schools. We found that students were taken to see their parents at work in the factories. Some small things like that. We had on this group a former Secretary of Labor in the United States, much interested in the field, Bill Wirtz, and other experts in the field. We found nothing there that we could profit from. We were also, as your comments imply, we were impressed more than we had before we went with the disaster of the Cultural Revolution, the destruction of the universities they then had, the degradation of their professors, and we met some who had been beaten and disgraced. And so once upon a time, there were so many people looking to China as a new way to do things, perhaps a new utopia. Quite frankly, we didn't find it that way. And apparently their leaders have made somewhat the same decision and are now looking toward more advanced societies, including our societies in North America, and abandoning some of their utopian claims. Yes?
Because of Japan's great industrial dominance, we're all asked to look at Japan. Now, how would you compare the top 20% of the Japanese students, including their high school, with our North Americans?
All right, the question from Mrs. Nemetz is the following. We hear so much about Japan today and its great industrial success. And how can we compare the ablest students in Japan with the ablest students in North America? I spent a fair amount of time in Japan in recent years at various conferences and so forth and so on. This is my evaluation of the system, which I might say is also the evaluation of quite a few Japanese experts. Their system is better than ours through the high school level, and particularly in mathematics. There was a study undertaken out of the University of Stockholm under Torsten Hussein, comparing the competence of students in a number of countries, Japan being one of them, altogether some 10 or 15 different countries, as well as could possibly be done with modern, more or less scientific methods. It was found that the high school students in Japan in mathematics were quite superior to students in any other country. This, of course, has advantaged them some in their training of engineers. They have twice the percentage of engineers in their society as in the United States. They put extraordinary pressure on their young people at the grammar school level and the high school level. Pressure from the parents and from the relatives, which in my feeling is sometimes absolutely cruel. They have a high, comparatively high rate of suicide at that level. Students, what they call Ronin, take exams year after year because of the pressure of their parents. The pressure is particularly intense in part because in Japan they have the belief in a very homogeneous society that everybody is born equally to everybody else, and that if a person fails, it's moral failure and not lack of capacity. So the pressure of the students, the parents on their young people, that it's a moral failure if they don't come out very much at the top. At that level, and with its costs, the best in the world. But their university system is, in my judgment, even when you take the great universities of Tokyo and Kyoto, far inferior to the quality of education given in the great research universities of North America, including UBC. The students, having gone through this intense pressure in high school, when they hit the universities, for them it's a kind of a free period. Some of them study, some of them don't. It's a free period, the only free period in their lives, between this tremendous pressure in their families and then, although this is decreasing, their lifetime employment. And so the tone of in North America, we put on more and more and more pressure. At the PhD, it's fantastic, the competition. They put on the tremendous pressure up to the level through the high school, and then they drop it off. I wish that we could get closer to what the Japanese do at the high school level. They would benefit enormously if they got closer to what we do at the college and university level. And to this day, they are still dependent upon our basic research. I spent 3 weeks last year in Japan. I was giving some lectures, and I'm also chairman of the board of a group called Work in America, which is a tripartite group concerned with productivity and quality of working life. And I'm chairman of the board, and along with the president, we were visiting a number of firms there, and I would say to them, trying to be polite, that probably never before in history had the teachers, the Americans after World War II, become the students. And they would correct me, and they would say, no, we're still the students. We get our basic research from you. And then with these engineers and by soliciting ideas on the shop floor, they make what we do 5 or 10% better, and that gives them the advantage. But it's quite clear in their minds that the basic thought and basic research still comes from Western Europe and particularly from the United States. That would be my evaluation of the situation. Yes? Yeah. Right.
Our students, they don't have a basic swing back and let the student?
Well, let me answer your question yes and then tell the audience what your question is. You asked the rhetorical question, have we lost something in the humanities that the students of today learn less of the classics than was once true in the older curricula? And haven't they lost something in the quality of their lives as a consequence? Certain of the humanities have lost. Our Carnegie Group made a study in the United States and found that the percentage of majors in the humanities in a very short period of time between 1969 and 1976 had gone down by one half. In the United States, our cultural revolution, the extent it affected academic activity was to put in this wave of electives, and that meant getting rid of general education. General education involved, to a good extent, the humanities. And then with the pressure of the labor market, students have the strange idea that they take one more course in accounting, they're going to get the job, you know, that they're going to want all the rest of their lives. And so for several reasons, certainly the humanities have gone down. I personally think this is quite a tragedy. Our Carnegie Group made a study through the Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan of how alumni look back on their college careers. What would they have done differently? I might say, with the exception of some fields like engineering, most of these alumni had never ended up in jobs which corresponded with the majors they'd taken on college. And yet the students trying to increase their majors to get, you know, their first job. And by a very high proportion, they said that they had wished they had taken more courses which would have broadened their intellectual and cultural interests. More courses in the humanities and more courses in the performing and creative arts. I think it's sad what has happened. But it's going to be very, very hard to reverse it. Well, you over here first.
Yes. Now that the University of California is again looking for a new president, one of the issues that seems to have come up in California a great deal is this idealistic notion of affirmative action.
Right.
In your view, what has been the successes and problems of those programs in California?
Well, the question is, and you asked specifically about the University of California, but the thing might be generalized to the United States. We have had this very great experiment in affirmative action, saying that universities must select students without reference to sex or without reference to their race or ethnic background, that faculties must be chosen the same way. There have been major effects of all of this. Without the pressure from the federal government, there would be fewer women in the faculties than there are today. There would be fewer women students in the United States now. The proportion of women in college universities is a little over 50%. I think that's going to go on up there. There are more reasons for women to go to college and university than for men. There are more things that men can do, like being an over-the-road truck driver to get a good income without college than for women. There are many more blacks. The proportion of blacks in colleges and universities is now almost equivalent to their proportion in the population as a whole. And if you look at it socioeconomic group by socioeconomic group, the proportion of blacks is higher than of the majority population in the upper socioeconomic groups. This has partly been the pressure of the federal government. It's been partly also the changing convictions of American society. As Gunnar Myrdal in his famous book, The American Dilemma, pointed out, we lived for a couple of centuries in great conflict between our announced principles and our practice. all men are created free and equal. But they weren't created free and equal when it came to getting an education and other opportunities in American society. And Gunnar Myrdal said that someday he thought that our principles would overcome our practices and that we would start living up to our principles, and we have done a great deal. The United States has changed enormously, and from my point of view, entirely for the better over the past 20 years. It's been a real revolution, never to be reversed. At the same time, there have been some terrible excesses by the administrators in Washington. At Berkeley, HEW insisted that the Berkeley campus plan ahead to the year something like 2005 as to how many people there would be among women and minorities in different departments at that time to set a goal. This is putting special pressure on Berkeley as a famous university and as a hopeful model for others. The Berkeley campus, the chancellor then, was a well-known statistician. He played games with this. The idea was you had to figure out the pool, how many women would have PhDs, how many American Indians would have PhD field by field in the year 2005, and then say that similar proportion ought to be, you know, in the faculty. So he came out 50,000 calculations on a computer. In the year 2005, the Berkeley campus ought to have 1/10 of a full-blooded American Indian in the classics department. Well, this is really counterproductive. You know, it was really kind of nonsense. The University of North Carolina was ordered at one point by the HEW to undertake no academic changes, no new academic plans, to put them into effect until HEW in Washington had 6 months to review the plans and to approve or disapprove them before the University of North Carolina could put them into effect. I personally thought that was a very unwise thing, an enormous intrusion into university autonomy. And Ted Hesburgh, president of Notre Dame, former chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, fired by President Nixon. He and I have many things in common. Because of his insistence on civil rights and the importance of civil rights, and I were prepared to testify, if it came to that, before the courts on behalf of the University of North Carolina. Find them in violation of the law after the fact if you want to, but don't have this prior control. So that I would fault the bureaucracy or some members of the bureaucracy for having become overzealous and given affirmative action a rather bad name in some quarters. However, I would say that the effort which was undertaken has not only opened up new opportunities for many women and many minorities, but it was extraordinary importance to the soul of America. All right, you.
You mentioned conservatism of our academic environment and our institutions. You mentioned the fact that you're lacking leadership, and yet by the year 2000 we have to have a great change. What do you see the shape of?
Yeah. Well, the question or the point is this, that academic institutions are very conservative. They always have been. There's some good aspects of that, let me say, because the very conservatism of the institution makes it a lot easier for the members within it, you know, kind of do their own thing. and the difficulty of getting leadership for change in a period when we need to keep on changing in order to be still dynamic in the year 2000. I think there are some things that can be done. I wouldn't expect drastic changes by the year 2000. I do hope that there have been some dynamic adjustments to the changing intellectual world and needs of societies. There are some things that can be done. Our Carnegie Group recommended that each institution, as a matter of policy, and some have done this, in fact, one case, Western Reserve, went for a while quite beyond it, as a matter of policy, ought to say, in every year, we're going to discontinue some reasonable proportion of our activity so we can add something new. We suggested the policy be somewhere between 1 and 3%. These would be policies of the board and policies of the faculty. We'll discontinue, we'll go through what we're doing, discontinue 1 to 3% a year, put in something new, 1 to 3%. That can make a difference. I think another thing which can be done, and contrary to the practice in a number of institutions, is that when faculty positions become vacant, with an exception that anybody who's a faculty member will recognize the importance of, some of the rest of you won't think it's very important, the exception being that somebody is on the ladder and up for tenure, and if they don't make tenure, I would say that position was not open. But when positions become open by resignation or retirement, you see, if you say somebody doesn't make tenure, and then you seize, which is my point, the position for a central pool for reassignment, then they may promote people that shouldn't be promoted just to save their FTE. But where positions become open, that they go to a central pool for reassignment and not be retained in the department, this involves tremendous battles some places where departments think they own the FTE. I think for the sake of higher education, the individual institution, open FTE should belong to the university or the college to be reassigned to the best places for the academic growth of the institution. Those are two things which can be done, and which, if they were done, would create the possibility for reasonable change, even in a period which makes change difficult. Yes. Between academic growth and economic prosperity.
No, is there a relationship between, on one hand, quality, and on the other, growth and economic prosperity?
Well, I would say it's easier to improve quality when you have prosperity. It's just much easier. You have money to spend on the new things, money, you know, to recruit and faculty members you want any place.
So, but if you feel there is a direct relationship?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, you probably, and today we talk about this as anybody else, it's become fashionable in the last 20 years or so for politicians to make careers out of active education. Of course, in California, higher education was under attack in the 60s.
Right. Well, the question just asked is to say that there has been a tendency by politicians in the States and also in Canada, specifically British Columbia, to find advantage and political advantage in attacking education. And why is this so? And as you indicated at the start of your remarks, this is a subject which is not entirely foreign to my own experience of having seen the attacks in California. Let me say, I saw these attacks. Governor Reagan, when he was running for governor, one of his major campaign speeches. Was against the University of California. In fact, he partly ran against the University of California. I went through a period when there was an Un-American Activities Committee of the Senate of the State of California, headed by Senator Burns, who was the chairman of the Senate in California. So I've seen some of this. I'd like to modify what you say, having been on the receiving end of some of these attacks. My impression is this. Certainly in the United States, and I think also in Canada, the people have a very great faith in education. The public opinion polls show this. They're devoted to it. As I've seen it, the politicians are rather careful not to attack education as such, but some aspect of education which they think is currently unpopular. And I did not interpret, the same time that Governor Reagan was attacking the University of California generally, and me in particular, on the grounds that I had been reluctant to use police against students except as a last resort. I had to make two very tough decisions about that. I regret many things I did, but I never regretted those decisions to hold off the police. At the same time, I do think they can be brought in as a last resort. The same time he was attacking this aspect, I was out around the state carrying a bond issue, the last bond issue the University of California ever carried, a very substantial bond issue, and arguing the merits of the University of California to the people of the state and getting good support. So my interpretation is that the politicians, as I've seen them, are careful not to attack education as such, but something which at the moment is unpopular in education. And certainly, the student demonstrations were unpopular. In the United States, there are a good many politicians attacking the high schools on the grounds that the scores out of high school, the SAT or ACT scores, have gone down, and therefore there's something wrong with the high schools. But as I've seen them, it's attack against specifics, and that they really play upon the devotion that the people have to education and are essentially saying they would like to have education not be worse but be better as they speak to the public. That's how I've interpreted it from the receiving end. Or at any other, yes, over here.
These changes that you foretell, will they also apply to the so-called developing countries and the USSR?
Well, developing countries and the USSR, that's two different categories. Some developing countries still have tremendous growth ahead. China, that we were talking about, the Chinese go ahead with modernization, they're going to have the most massive growth of post-secondary education the world has ever seen, just because they got a billion people there. Fast growth of higher education in the OPEC oil countries still going on. Saudi Arabia is spending more money on each of two campuses, one in Riyadh and the other in Jeddah, then the University of California spent, you'd have to adjust some for inflation there, on the creation of 9 campuses. Generally in the developed world, they have a developing world, they still have some way to go, but they don't have the money now. And also, in my judgment, they somewhat overdid higher education at the expense of secondary education. They went first for literacy, and they went for higher education to develop an elite to replace the colonial administrators. I personally think the place that most of them need the great emphasis now is on secondary education. But certainly some of the developing countries, once again they have prosperity, and they're so badly caught by the declining prices of their commodities and the higher prices for what they buy, particularly oil, that they're stultified at the present time. I was really talking about the industrialized countries of the Western world. Elsewhere, there is still growth. USSR, just a word on that. I spent 3 weeks there last fall, imitation of the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And there, their system is totally planned, and planned upon the basis of manpower needs. It's a quite different system from our own. And as they see manpower needs growing gradually, they will increase the size of their system, a totally planned system. Do we have? Plus, we might just take one more as we put out. If there is one more question anyone has before we adjourn. All right, here. The what?
About secular.
Yeah.
Could you expand that a bit? I
talked about secular growth. I didn't talk about secular universities. I was talking about secular growth. From the point of view, I'm speaking as an economist, and I apologize for it. Economists talk about cyclical change, and then they talk about secular as being long run. And so when I talked about the secular development, I was speaking as an economist, meaning long run and having nothing to do with sex, you know, or anything. I didn't say sex, I said sects, S-E-C-T-S. And that was just a confusion on words.
I said secular as opposed to non-secular.
Yeah, well, secular, non-secular would be short term, and secular is long term. Anyway, I'm saying the secular, the long term prospects are excellent. I would love to be a young PhD about 1993 or 1994. There'll be jobs coming along then. I would love to be president of the University of British Columbia, say about 1997, with the prospect of replacing half the faculty in, you know, the next 5 years and redoing all those buildings. And those are the great things in the secular outlook. But in the long run, as Keynes said, you know, we're all dead. And we have to live, first of all, through the short run. And I have these short run concerns and this tremendous optimism about the long run. And thank you very much.
To express our gratitude to our speaker this evening, I'd call upon the president of the university, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Bill. Dr. Kerr, it is a great delight and a great pleasure to be here to thank you on behalf of the Vancouver Institute. It has been said on many occasions that Dr. Kerr perhaps has been the most influential person in higher education in the last two decades. That statement has usually been applied to the United States. I think it can be broadened in all sincerity, namely in the whole wide world, Dr. Kerr, that and you have brought here tonight demonstrable evidence why it is the case that you are the most influential person. The depth of your talk tonight, albeit at times perhaps a little depressing to some of us young people here, that is undoubtedly a very accurate picture of the prospects of higher education in the next 20 years. There are exceptions, however, for some institutions, and hopefully for the University of British Columbia. But talking seriously, that I think we've all gained tonight by a very clear and accurate picture of what the future may lie ahead for all of us in the next 20 years. On the other hand, Some of us who do believe you can reverse those trends would like to intervene and be activists, and I think that's in part what you may have been alerting a large number of us to tonight. And so on behalf of everyone here, I offer you our sincere thanks. We certainly hope you get to Poland, because we wish you back very quickly, sir. And thank you.